Hi, this is Dave. How's everybody doing?
Hi, Dave. It's Anne Marie.
Welcome. Hey, looking forward to your presenting your roadmap case study. What was the experience like for you for doing this, since you did it on yourself?
What was the experience? I knew you were going to ask that question.
Okay. Well, you can read minds now, too. You have another skill set.
It was a little scary, mainly because I guess I felt like there were so many areas that as we've gone through the last couple of weeks, there's been a few areas or a few topics that I thought I could really dive into for myself.
Uh-huh.
So there was always that, oh, am I doing it right? Am I not doing it right sort of thinking. But I've been thinking about it for the last 2 weeks and just, you know, we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, my other story of being a chronic procrastinator. And but I knew I was going to sit down yesterday to write it. And at first it felt a little forced, but then honestly, before I knew it, the words were writing themselves. And that's when it got
interesting,
very surreal.
Uh-huh.
And that, especially when I got to the back end, the A and the P, where I was starting to write I am and I will. I don't know. It was almost an outer body experience. That sounds so goofy, but that's really what it started to feel like as I was writing the M, the A, and the P. Actually, the M was the last part I wrote. Nothing changes was the last part I wrote because the A and the P just started to flow out of me so naturally that I just went with it. So it was extremely powerful because I really genuinely started to feel like a coach. All of that credibility stuff just went away as I owned the story, as I assessed how, you know, a little bit of how far back it went, but really expressing some of the ways that it displayed itself in my old job. And I don't know, it was not what I expected.
See, what you describe is a state of mind of flow. And it's when that state of being very grounded and centered you create, that you stay in and sustain,
mm-hmm.
It's a very creative state and it's self-perpetuating, and you get in that state. And it's been studied a lot in the last couple of decades in terms of the positive psychology group talking about flow. But it's really a state of mind that it just seems like things flow. You lose track
mm-hmm.
of time. And you get in that that immersion. So that's a state that is one of many, many states, dozens of states. And that's a state that is important, as we talked before about how when you're doing a certain work, you want to access or enter the optimum state for that piece of work. So you now know how to do that state of mind for self-reflection, perhaps for meditating, perhaps for creating, and looking at brainstorming things, and looking at yourself, your practice, whatever you decide to do, because that's a particular access that you have. That's a process that is a bonus in a way to the material, or is very much part of it actually.
Uh-huh.
So thanks for describing that. I think it's something we can all learn from, and I
certainly learned from it. The one piece as I was going through the case study and deciding how to write my write up my experience and what was in my head, I went through the case study and I just sort of picked out the key words that seemed to capture the essence of each of the steps. So recognizing authorship, I am aware. Owning your story, now I can own. You know, so that's the first thing I wrote, actually, was as I was going through. I wrote nothing more than those first few words in each of the sections and then went back to each section. And like I said, some of the sections felt a little bit more, they flowed more naturally. They were all in my head, and I just, they're just certain sections, it was easier to put words behind them versus certain ones were very much, much more healing. And it was harder, and here we go. And it was harder to, harder to put words behind the healing. But
go ahead.
I was just, I definitely broke it down into a little bit of a process so that I could also help take somebody else through that or myself through it again. Like I said, there's three or four other topics, but I'd love to do this for myself. But.
And what I'm hearing you saying is that you experienced each of the steps being a verb, because each of the first words of the steps are a verb. And when you started mm-hmm. with I and then move into that verb, you're in a different place. You're in a present moment writing your story. There's no history in the present tense.
Okay. So, and I think that was critical to not get wrapped up, especially in the assess, to not get wrapped up in the baggage and the drama and the the woe is me, but just instead to be very factual and very, this happened. And no judgment, no regret. This happened. Now what's next? So, I am a very emotional person. I tend to be much more sort of right-brained, irrational. So to be able to have the framework and a little bit of that process was very, very helpful for me to stay present and grounded and to let it flow.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that. I'm glad it was helpful, and you really personalized a process that I think is so essential, and if you feel that it's going to be helpful as well for your clients, bonus. That's going to be great, because if first was useful for you, that's really what's important. So that's and your dog is picking up your energy field, and it's second.
Every single time I get on the phone, to say the dog. I have two dogs. And the
something
one,
really exciting about it.
Yeah. I think it's the fact that I lock myself in the office and that, you know, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is her way of, yeah.
Well, super. Well, thank you very much. Let's check in with who else is here and what's going on.
Yeah, I know Grace is
I'm here.
Okay.
Grace, go ahead. Didn't I hear Grace? The unmuted Grace? I guess I didn't. Who did I hear?
This is Emmy, but I think you heard Grace, and I think she stopped, but I just wanted to say that I was here, but
okay,
I don't have anything.
Go ahead. Bring us up to date. Emmy, what's going on for you?
Okay. I was in New York last week, and so I wasn't online last week. I'm having a really hard time with the jet lag and figuring out time.
Oh, yeah. That's right, because we just had a time change, and you're in British. You're still in British summertime, aren't you? You changed just recently.
No, we changed the week before, so
yeah,
I was
right,
on an hour later.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then last week I was in New York.
And then we changed, yeah. Right, right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I've been following along on the audios, on the audio.
How is the material, the reading, and what you're hearing in the seminars, how is that impacting you? Any thoughts or questions or even just reflections on what that experience is for you?
Well, I found it interesting because I actually have the recordings from last year's session. So I've been hearing those before I actually come on to the audio.
How did you have access to those?
I was sent those. So
yeah, Dave, that was the original one that we were sent before the problem was fixed.
Oh, okay, that's right. My IT guy did not.
Yep.
Apologies for that. Okay. Okay. Yeah, go ahead. I interrupted you.
Oh, it's not. It's okay. So I enjoy that because it's actually for me, I'm very for me, it's very, audio is very good for me. So for me, I hear it twice, and for me, that's I think really good. I like that. I like hearing that. And
I'm going to put a little pressure on me to change up some of my stories.
Yeah. So for me, that's a really good thing, so that I can actually the information is absorbed more for me. Thank you for that.
Okay, well, great. And again, if any of you have any challenges with any of your coaching cases or vignettes or anything like that you want to talk about, feel free, or anything that you're working on yourself or things from the reading or the seminars that, you know, we didn't cover, feel free to bring them up. Is Grace back on the line? Is Stephanie here? Okay, well, anything that you'd like to talk about or discuss in any way before we do Anne-Marie's case? Anything that's come up in any aspect, whether it's reading the seminars or your work with the clients, that would be helpful to talk about? Okay, well, let's launch into your presentation. Anne-Marie, are you ready?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, great.
Dave, is it just okay to go ahead and read through?
Sure. However you'd like to.
Okay.
Okay.
And I'm perfectly happy to share this, or if you'd like to share it out with folks. Hopefully you heard a little bit of the background as Dave and I were talking about my thought process as I was creating my case study. My case study is my own. It's what I call my new credibility story. Credibility is something that I have struggled internally with for the better part of my life, I think. And it has especially reared its head in my coaching practice. I'm coming out of a corporate career of 23 years, a career that ended not quite under the circumstances I would have expected it to end. And so starting a second career much earlier in life than I thought I might. And this is certainly my passion and the place I saw myself long term, but not necessarily how I expected it to start. So the internal credibility struggle is where I chose to really, really chose to do the case study, because I was realizing some places where it was really starting to hold me back in my coaching practice and in generating income, revenue particularly. So in the recognition part, I am aware now that I am the author of my internal credibility story, although previously I would have seen it as a normal part of my process. Every time I face a new challenge or am in an unfamiliar context. So normally I would have said, this is just how I need to feel, or just how everybody feels or should feel. It's part of maybe cutting teeth in a new situation, and everybody should go through this. And a lot of shoulds in this world for me. From an ownership standpoint, now I can own my internal credibility story, even though it is painful to acknowledge that I have likely been in my own way and missed out on opportunities because I either haven't felt prepared enough or that I don't belong with certain people or in certain circumstances. So I have a palpable level of discomfort when I'm in certain situations where I feel like my lack of credentials, which I'm realizing now is all made up in my head, but my lack of credentials are obvious and others are judging me for the lack of credentials. So much of it really came out as I was doing this next part, the assess, the plot, and storyline. So I have a great education, Bachelor's of Science in Chemical Engineering, which, you know, so proud of, have had many successes in my previous career, so 23 years in a large consumer goods company doing consumer research. But I usually felt, but it was more often than not, I felt like I didn't deserve much of what I had and that I would be exposed as a fraud eventually. So the understory there is I felt like I was running on luck more often than not. I avoided calling myself an expert at all costs despite people seeking me out for my knowledge, my experience, and my successes. I didn't position myself or assert myself in critical conversations for fear of looking stupid amongst senior management or being judged or saying the wrong thing or you name it. I felt less than. My identity came to be about the company that employed me rather than what I earned or accomplished. So more often than not, when I would introduce myself, I would say, I am an employee or I work for, as opposed to here's who I am. And it became a not good enough mindset that carried over to coaching. And I found myself taking every training class imaginable to build my expertise. And here I worried more than ever that I would never be as skilled or successful as those around me. I felt like I was starting over, learning again. It really, like I said, this is really where it came to bear. I continued to find myself uncomfortable in meetings with my peers, worried that I didn't have the credentials or track record to be included among them. And here's where I really relied on my sense of humor to poke fun at myself, often using self-deprecating humor during introductions or sharing with experiences, thinking that my sense of humor or laughter could mask what must be obvious to others. And what started happening is it would work against me. I would find that what was really happening is people had trouble taking me seriously because it seemed as though I wasn't taking me seriously, with the sense of humor and the laughter sort of being that first thing that would come through. And then really most detrimental, I had difficulty following up with potential clients, if I followed up at all, because I didn't feel prepared to coach them. I was worried I would let them down. I just have not been given myself any credit in this space. So in the what to change, deciding what to change, I mean, really, there's a lot of let go in here for me, Dave. I had keep and I had enhance, but so much of this is really, I just had to let go of the thought, the belief that I'm not credible, exactly where I am today, letting go of, or keeping my valuable experience and expertise, but letting go that it couldn't, the belief that it couldn't be relevant in this case, letting go of the belief that there was this carrot in front of me and that when I caught the carrot, that's when that magical moment of credibility would come, and the reality is that moment doesn't come. I just had to grab the carrot. In the enhanced world, I really am making the conscious effort and the conscious decision now to enhance when and how I show up as a coach in every interaction, and not just in every interaction, in how I get out of bed in the morning. And that's where my mapping the changes really became a walk the talk for myself. I'm realizing none of this credibility is anything external. It's not anything anybody has ever said to me. It's not anything that's ever been any feedback that's ever been given to me. This is me. This is me making this stuff up in my head. So in mapping my changes, I found myself making a very long to-do list and then looking at the to-do list and saying, what are the themes? What is it I'm trying to tell myself here? And what it really came down to is doing things daily to act and feel like a coach, that this is my full-time job, that I am a credible and reliable resource in this world, and what are the things that I need to do from the moment I get out of bed to the moment I get back into bed to be a coach. And that's where things like creating and maintaining a daily schedule, practicing positive affirmations, crystallizing my business plan, and especially the pieces that I've been procrastinating on, like my marketing plan, where I need to put myself out, where and when I need to put myself out there. Setting goals. I actually looked at it as what would you do if this was a project in the old world, in the old job? And credibility was the goal. Credibility was the target. So everything on my mapping changes has to do with what I need to do to reassure myself and to act and feel like a coach. As I was saying earlier, the offering new experiences and programming new experiences was an extremely, extremely powerful experience for me, because in that process of saying I am and I will, I felt like somebody else was starting to write. And I really genuinely started to become a coach, a credible coach in my own mind in those moments. So by saying things like, I am a certified coach who can successfully guide clients through the inventions of their personal and professional lives. I am more than qualified today to seek and out and take on as many clients as my schedule will allow. I have an engaging and powerful story to tell that will resonate with many people. Just those words of I am and I have and I can make a difference in people's lives because I care about people and I am passionate about the coaching process. Instead of saying I will try or I might or that process of really writing the sentences in the present. And then what does that new experience and the new identity need to look like to really become me? That's where the will word. I made sure every one of these sentences had I will. My identity will be that of a credible, successful coach from this day forward. I will take every opportunity to show up strong, confident, and in control of my business success. I will actively seek out new clients by leveraging my story and sharing what I offer that is different and special. This process, I wrote more. I'm happy to share all of it. But this process was extremely powerful. And I woke up different today. I can't describe it, but I woke up a coach. And a coach in control and a coach that's found and determined to be successful in this business.
Wow, congratulations. Thank you for sharing that and for really going through the process with us of letting us see and experience the change and the transformation inside you. So that's a real treat. Well, let's open it up. Any thoughts or responses or feedback from anyone?
Have you been journaling as you go through this? I was just wondering how you kept track.
I didn't, and in hindsight, I wish I would have. What I have been doing, and what I called on a little bit, was going through my business notes. So going through the notebook that I use, it's not necessarily a journaling notebook, but my note-taking during different business conversations, training classes, et cetera. And what I did was I put myself back in some of those situations where, I was in those moments of those discussions and remembering some of the head trash that was going through my mind during some of those discussions. And I wish I would have journaled a little bit more about the thoughts and feelings. But I'll be honest with you, this old story is so ingrained in me, this credibility thing is so ingrained in me, that it didn't take very much to bubble it up. It's something I wrestle with every day. And it's not anything anybody has ever said to me. Nobody has ever looked at me and said, you are not credible. So it didn't take much of reviewing of notes and things like that to kind of get me to be able to own and recount a little bit of that story.
Thanks.
Terrific. And I think it really illustrates something that is so essential as a final step for that internal transformation, because you've talked about how before you would make changes, you would do things in a different way, behave in a different way, but felt as if you might be seen as a fraud, be exposed, and an identity was as a part of a larger whole. And what I hear that's supremely different is that the changes that you've created and the way you see yourself has permeated how and who you see yourself to be, the internal model that perceives and organizes things. That final P is the identity, and I think being inside that experience creates a different way of seeing, experiencing, and a different way of feeling, so that it's as if there's a new process going on, and you are aware of feeling different as a person because of the different position you take vis-a-vis yourself, your story, your own authority, and every aspect of what you described is moving from a transitional or a passive or an observing statement to being in the middle of it. I will. I am. And being inside the experience that you're authoring, and it's not a, you know, not a future tense. It's not a past tense. So I think this is a great illustration, and I think it can really inform what you do with clients. Because, for example, when a client will say, "Well, I'm going to try to do this," you know, I quote one of the great philosophers of the 20th century: "Try not, do or do not. There is no try." That was Yoda. And ask them to look at when will they be ready to make a full commitment, and if it's now, what is that now? And that will usually begin with "I will." So I think, I mean, that's something that I do all along in working with someone, and you're very aware of it too. I think it's going to make a big difference as well in your coaching, because you're helping to actively construct and co-construct a new story, and that's moment by moment. So I think that's really powerful. Any other thoughts or questions or comments?
Well, I found myself, and I was very, I mentioned I was very deliberate as I was writing the author and program pieces, to start everything with "I am," or "I will," so present and future tense. Even though as I started the process, I might not necessarily have completely believed it, by the time I was done doing that, I found myself asking, well, what's stopping you? What's stopping this from being true today? What are you waiting for? What that carrot that you always put in front of you, which you've never been able to grab, by the way, Avery, what if you had it in your hand? How would these statements be any different? And that's when it hit me. They wouldn't be any different. This is, you know, this is what that carrot will feel like. And why I left the map piece for the end was, now what are those things that you need to do every day to truly, truly live this new experience? And why I couldn't, just again, the way my brain was operating, I could not do the math to change it until I wrote that new experience. Until I said, this is who I am today, and what are those things that I believe I need to do to feel and behave that way every single day.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of a fake it till you feel it type of thing, which was also going through my head. But I was the only one that knew I was faking it. Everybody else already believes it to be true.
Well, in a sense, you weren't faking it. You were doing something new that before you had defined as fake, but it was simply something new, and by definition, it's uncomfortable. And see, in a similar way, I think the way our minds and brains work, I think it happens in reverse to how it's usually considered, that the usual thinking about it is there'll be something that we have a doubt about, or we have an old story about, and you know, that we stop ourselves. I think it happens in reverse. I think that in most instances, when there's something that's new or different that we haven't done before, there's the uncertainty, there's anxiety, and the anxiety then cues and boots up an old state of mind that makes it make sense to stop. So that, remember, decisions are made first in the midbrain and then booted up to our forebrain to make it make sense. So it will light on something that makes it make sense to stop or seem rational or logical or intellectual, but I think the feeling always comes first. And the feeling then determines the state of mind that we use, and the state of mind determines then the meaning we attach and the behavior. So I think the feeling and the experience comes first, then the state of mind, and then the whole process of what we do. And you described a transformation of all of that and the way that you stay present, and that's going to determine then how you're going to proceed. State always comes first. So I think it's a great example of some things that we've been talking about in a very experienced, near applied way, and in really powerful detail.
Well, thank you, because of course I went through it not sure if I was doing it the right way, the wrong way. I just went with it.
And that's good, because it wasn't the right way, and that's part of your new story. It's not fitting into anything external that is perceived or judged inside. It's yours. It's not there until you create it. So that's a different way of proceeding, and it feels different. So thank you so much for sharing that. I think it's really a powerful illustration and application of and creative application of what we've been talking about.
I appreciate the opportunity. I really do. It's not like me to jump in and be first. So there was something here that I definitely wanted to go through it sooner versus later. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, great. Excellent. I'm glad you did. We all benefited from it. Well, I do want to move into our material, and again, feel free to interrupt me at any time. We're going to talk about advancing the plot now. This is from Module 5, and with this seminar, I want to bring together what we've been discussing about guiding change and facilitating growth in ourselves and in others. And then beginning next session, we're going to talk about niche applications. But life stories usually change in three ways: when existing solutions no longer work, when situations change, or if possibilities introduce or require new approaches. Sometimes we just come to the end of a story cycle and recognize that we don't have a new one waiting for us to step into. It's been said that the end of an era is when all its basic illusions have ended. So how do you make sense of new information that doesn't fit into an existing framework? Because usually we ignore it until we no longer can. Now, as alchemists, we help people see possibility to engage a transformative process, and we certainly just heard one. So I want to consider with you three kinds of empathy, because this is some of the foundation principle that we use in working with clients. Empathy is a listening perspective inside the experience of another. It's our ability to place one foot in the shoe of another to resonate with someone else's experience, including how that person thinks, feels, constructs meaning, and communicates. In other words, to know as much as possible about their subjective reality and to not get lost there, to keep one foot in our shoe. As we talk about how we read and respond to others' experiences, I want to consider three kinds of empathy and the upside and downside of each. One is cognitive empathy, to know the perspective of another person and what that person might be thinking, how they're processing things intellectually. This can help, for example, in negotiation and finding a way to motivate people and in coaching. A study at the University of Birmingham found that managers who were good at taking another's perspective, cognitive empathy, were able to help workers achieve their best efforts. Now, the downside with only cognitive empathy, it can result in a cold calculation, understanding another's point of view without taking emotions into account. It can be an informed detachment. A second is emotional empathy, when you can sense what other people experience as though their emotions are contagious, which we now know they are. This emotional contagion occurs largely because of mirror neurons in the brain, a complex set of neural response patterns that fire when we sense another's emotional state, and the energy field of transfer of energy from amygdala to amygdala, midbrain to midbrain. We sense the echo of another's experience in our own minds and bodies. This emotional empathy attunes us to another person's emotional world. This is immensely valuable in coaching, and I believe it can happen absolutely as well by telephone as it can face-to-face. Now, the downside with only emotional, let me think about that in a different way with you. At times with emotional empathy, we may have difficulty managing our own emotions if they're powerful or if they're distressing enough. We also have to protect ourselves from depletion, from psychological exhaustion, especially if you're a feeler, even more so if you're an intuitive empath. And a couple of you have already done this from an earlier time that we spent together. If you haven't, I would suggest Googling intuitive empath, I-N-T-U-I-T-I-V-E, empath, E-M-P-A-T-H. Looking at one of the top two or three articles, and you'll read about yourself, and to look at what you need to do as an intuitive empath to protect yourself from toxic people or influences, people who want to, deposit negative experiences or draw from your energy without giving anything back. It might be interesting just to look at that. Now, here's an example, my own experience during Hurricane Katrina. We witnessed high-level leaders being curiously detached, despite abundant evidence that they needed to take action. I saw on television the suffering and misery that people in New Orleans experienced. And my own response was exaggerated because I did some of my medical training in New Orleans. And my response was, I know those people. I spend Novembers there writing in the French Quarter. I treated some of those people. That guy wading through the water, carrying his baby, I could have delivered him when he was born. So that's the downside, to get way over-involved. Too little involvement, on the other hand, could be indifference. The balance is informed caring that doesn't get in the way of the client having all of his or her experience and working with it. To resonate with that experience, to create common ground, but to allow the client to have and work fully inside their own experience without intrusions. So, empathy is not an end in itself. It's a means to a better end. Now, it's very analogous to when someone carefully crafts a speech or tells a story. The art is to allow the emotional response to reside in the listener or reader. Rather than expressing yourself or suggesting how someone should respond, you facilitate the client to have his or her own experience. We can learn from the poets who give it to the reader or listener to experience themselves. And a third one, compassionate empathy. The resonance with another, the experience and knowledge that we are all connected. An example of a balance, staying cool in a crisis, but sometimes allowing ourselves to regulate this coolness enough to get charged up in order to help somebody in need. So a judgment call and compassionate empathy to recognize where and when you can't do or be effective and where you can be effective to be able to put your energy into what you can be effective in doing. Now, a couple of caveats of empathy. If you move into abstraction, it's less real. There's a drop-off of empathy as you move further away from the real experience of people. For example, someone may feel more empathy for a puppy with a hurt paw than for a person without health insurance. The person without health insurance is a statistic, one among 51 million others. And that's reducing, but the puppy is one specific focus for feeling. Another example. A neuroscience study published in Science magazine shows that, and we talked about this, when something bad happens to someone we envy, the result is that we feel good. We feel pleasure that we derive from their humiliation. And University of Cambridge fMRI scan showed that the region of the brain that responds to conflict and social rejection will activate during these times. Now, let's look at mind maps, the brain's story. The brain connections, or mind maps, influence the reality that we see. The mind map is the brain's story. A paradigm, which is roughly synonymous with a mind map, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. Now, the paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. With the right map, planning and strategy can make a huge difference. Each of us has a number of maps or paradigms in our head, our storylines. We're often unaware of having them, assuming that we just see things the way they are. These paradigms, which is also roughly synonymous with a state of mind, because you boot up a state of mind, it's like a separate software package. So this is our state determines the meaning we attach and the way we see things. So it also determines how we think and behave. Now, we originally construct beliefs to make sense of our experiences in the world. These beliefs and the experiences from them then confirm our models of the world, really form our models of the world. And the models become, the models come from the models that we see parents operating on, that we see significant others, that we download in an identificatory process. They become models of what really works for us and what doesn't work. They are a way that we consciously and unconsciously recognize what's effective and what's not. So the way our minds work is that each situation boots up a particular map, a particular state of mind. And we now know, and this is very recent, like a couple of years ago, how the mind works very much, and our brains work very much like a Google map. We see a situation, and it boots up a map to deal with it. We see a different situation, boots up a different map. So we relate what we perceive to something we know, which immediately suggests action options. Now, a danger is that we place the new into the container of the known, the old, which could prevent new learning. Another challenge is to make a continuity of this experience, a story, instead of just a collection of scenes. So a mind map simply allows us not to have to discover again each time what something means, what its purpose is, how to deal with it. It's like going the same route to work each day so you don't have to think about it. You can think about other things or read an audiobook. You don't have to relearn the route each time. So what we then do is see if these routes, if these mind maps, these automatic way of responding, if they work or if there are better ways to do that. Beliefs become effective ways to use previous experiences to navigate. They become part of our mind map. Now, UCLA research professor Marilyn Kurowski found that 97% of kindergartners think out of the box, but only 3% of people by age 30 do. Now, kindergartners don't plan ways to think out of the box. They've just not constructed a box yet. They haven't had enough repeated experiences to create default modes at a lot of new things, so they keep a beginner's mind. Now, the box is a personal construction. It's a belief system that is actively created, consciously and unconsciously, to shape perception and processing, to make things automatic. At times, a way to think outside the box is simply to suspend judgment and approach something with the beginner's mind. We often prompt a client to do that. If they're stuck about something, it opens the door to possibilities. One of our uniquely human qualities is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. Having this ability, we can learn from both our own experiences and from those of others. And recall the white paper that I sent for the mentor group last Monday about mindfulness and ways to think about that in terms of coaching. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We can think about these things and reflect on them. We can examine our paradigms to see if they're serving us well. We can decide what to keep, what to let go, what to enhance, what to avoid. Now, a dilemma means having two or more mental maps in conflict. So, from a coaching perspective, we want to look at least two broad levels. One is a macroscopic level, the big one, selecting the mental map that's most productive for a given task, or even developing a new map or a meta map. An example that we've talked about before is to correctly read the anxiety or the uncertainty of a new endeavor as validation of moving ahead beyond the comfort zone, rather than in an old model as a signpost of danger or an indication from your gut or from your intuition that this is not the right thing to do. And secondly, at a microscopic level, awareness of the choices of this moment and picking the best one. An example of this: if you label something wrong, you're going to write the wrong story. You'll use the wrong map. For example, if you feel bad saying no to someone who asks you to do something or asks you, you know, for something, if you feel bad saying no and then label that feeling that you have, the slight discomfort, as guilt, then you're going to use a different map than, for example, if you see it as setting an appropriate boundary, where no simply means no, and you're taking care of yourself. No truly means no, thank you. I choose to focus on something else right now. And it's a simple choice based on some very basic emotional and reasonable decision. So look at how you label something, because that's going to determine everything else that follows. Remember, we talked about conversational intelligence. The first few words are going to boot up potentially a totally different mindset in the listener, depending on the one hand, if it's pejorative, critical, judgmental, or simply just factual, as opposed to if it's one of engagement, if it's one of collaboration that boots up the neurochemical oxytocin for a connection and bonding, and everything that follows, the entire conversation that follows, will be from a different mindset. Now, here's an example of a conflicting mindset, a dilemma, two mental maps that go in the opposite direction. A client of mine, an attorney, was asked by her dad, I'd like you to be the executor of my estate. Well, his daughter responded, okay, Dad, first I'll need to know some basic things about your property and your wishes. He said, well, that's none of your business. Now, remember, again, the map is not the territory. That is, beliefs are not reality, at least not consensual reality. Beliefs are only the negotiations we construct to deal with the subjective realities that we each experience. So we need to recognize that we each create our own stories, to take ownership of those stories, then we can assess what needs to change, be enhanced, be ignored. Now, I think it's important to review again when we're talking about this and doing things that are going to advance the plot, how beliefs drive behavior. And beliefs determine the experiences and the results of what we do, because we always make our beliefs come true. If you believe no one will love you, you're going to interpret behavior and perceive responses in exactly that way, and even act so that you'll either block intimacy or not be lovable. You act in such a way to teach people how to respond to you. This actualizes your beliefs and validates your assumptions. Beliefs are the directives, the software of your mind to make something happen in your life. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. Remember that fundamental equation that we talked about very early on. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. So one way to determine core beliefs is to assess the results you're getting in your life. Outcome is not measured by intention. Intention doesn't matter. It's measured by results. So, examine the results in each of the different domains or storylines of your life: financial, career, relationship, personal, wellness. consider that if someone is getting a better result, they may have a different, better, or more empowering belief. And one simple way to get to someone's core belief about something is simply to ask, well, but how do you know that? And they'll usually tell you their belief. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. And the most common source of resistance is to hold on to an old belief and expect new results. To continue to write the story that you want to believe, simply because it would take a process of grief and mourning, perhaps, to give it up. You know, it's the hardest, perhaps the hardest thing to give up is what might have been. Because when you take that final step into the present, you recognize that you didn't really get what you wanted in the past, and by giving it to yourself now and being solidly in the present, you acknowledge you'll never get it in the way you wanted it. But it also frees you to be totally in the present. One person I heard, I'll put it very simply, I've relinquished all hope for a better past. Now, let's revisit the idea of comfort zones. A comfort zone is a familiar pattern of behavior, as you know. It's a gradual process, but once established, resists change. And think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. If your temperature decreases or increases, signals an immediate adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both contribute. We even have a comfort zone with our weight. We return to the familiar even when we don't like it or when it's uncomfortable. Everything we do, we have a comfort zone, because anything that we repeat, our brain, from an evolutionary standpoint, grooves neural networks and pathways to make it automatic because it's energy efficient. So the comfort zone is predictable and automatic. We know the outcome. And think about how subtle a comfort zone can be in determining choices, what you eat, the difficulty of starting a new exercise program. A comfort zone can be a behavior pattern, like self-effacing jokes, or a state of mind, such as responding angrily to certain situations. It can be the repeated role you play in a relationship, or procrastination of lifestyle changes you need to make. So a comfort zone can manifest in certain patterns, not just an immediate response, but in more complex patterns, like working under pressure, waiting until the last minute, creating a crisis. All can be comfort zones. Or someone can be an underdog and succeed against all odds, but then that becomes a comfort zone when the same pattern is repeated over and over, so that escalating success and overcoming odds becomes the default mode. Here's an example of a comfort zone in action. Most lottery winners manage to spend or give away their newfound earnings to return to their previous situation. In the United States, 80% of lottery winners over $3 million file bankruptcy within the first 5 years. Their money changed, but their mindsets didn't. So much money moved them from their comfort zone, and they ended up returning to it. Now, remember, a habit is not a definition. It's a collection of repetitions. It's a choice that gets repeated. In the beginning, departure from a comfort zone feels uncomfortable. It's a rupture of continuity. Routine's broken. Sometimes letting go of a comfort zone occurs only when the pain is too great to remain in it. But the choices we make usually tend to be from our comfort zone. But a comfort zone, remember, can trade passion for predictability, creativity for continuity, and the new for the familiar. So, to break out of a comfort zone, sometimes we have to tolerate, usually have to tolerate the discomfort, the uncertainty, the different experience that we're unfamiliar with, and the results will likely go outside our self-image, because that's usually the last of the components of change, and transition that we make, as we heard in Anne Marie's really excellent write-up about how programming new identity was kind of the hub around which everything else evolved in one way of looking at it. Now, here's an example I heard from Jack Canfield talk about his stepdad. He said that his stepdad was a regional manager for NCR. This was in the late 70s, early 80s. He noticed that each of his salespeople had a particular image of themselves as a salesperson. They were like a $2,000 a month salesperson or a $3,000 a month salesperson. If that salesperson's self-image was that he earned around $3,000 a month in commissions, then when he got to that figure, each month he'd kind of slack off until the next month. But if it were close to the end of the month and he'd only earned, say, $1,200 or $1,500, he would work 16-hour days, weekends, beat the bushes until he got to $3,000. So a comfort zone is an unconscious thermostat until it becomes conscious. Then you can reprogram your mind and brain. Now, one thing to consider, we talked about states of mind, about how you can get marooned in your right brain from emotion. Let's consider how we can get marooned in our left brain. A thought loop is mentally replaying the same thoughts, reviewing the same scenarios again and again. You can't find an exit. You can't think or logic your way out of it because it's a state of mind. A thought loop drains energy, leads to no new solutions. It seems like focusing, but it's really obsessing. Now, think of a time when you got into a thought loop, an argument with a partner, a disappointing review, upsetting information about your child. Thought loops are being marooned in your left brain. And usual precipitance are hurt, helplessness, disappointment. And the thought loop can become a repetition of, well, if I'd only done this, or this is what I should have said. And part of that thought loop, once you're in that state of mind, includes picking things in the environment that fit into the thought cycle. You choose the data that confirms your belief. Mark Twain said, I've lived a long time and I've had a lot of troubles. Some of them actually even happened. Now, think about how you can apply the roadmap process even to a thought loop, a state of mind like this, to recognize that you're in it, to observe the triggers that initiate that thought loop. Remember the four-column neural conditioning. To look at the triggers or the cues, to look at the usual response or behavior, to assess the best response, to pre-plan what you want to do, both in terms of getting grounded and where you want to get to, ideal behavior. Determine the next best action. Map changes. Map them by putting in that fourth column exactly what you want to do for each cue or each trigger. Author new experiences. Staying present, since worry or a negative thought loop is a state of mind, is a way of countering it. Because once you're in a state, once you've moved from that first column to the second column, from a cue or trigger that bumps you to a particular state of mind, you're in a state of mind, and that has a fixed focal length. You can't reason or logic or feel your way out of it. But you can move out of it by getting grounded and centered and getting to then ultimately an ideal behavior. So get very present. Worry is a state of mind. And rather than continuing to focus on the content of the specific worry, focus on the process, on getting centered, grounded, relaxed. So the antithesis of worry is not to stop worrying, it's to be aware of this flow of how a cue creates a change of state and to recognize that as early in the process as possible to get grounded and move into an ideal behavior until ultimately, again, that cue or trigger will automatically move you to that ideal behavior. That's the way it takes work. Let's talk for a moment about choice architecture, because I think this is a useful thing to consider in terms of coaching, and I'll tell you how to apply it, or how I think about applying it in just a moment. An example of choice architecture is a study at a local car wash that ran a promotion featuring loyalty cards. Every time a customer bought a car wash, you got a stamp on the card, and when you fill the card with 8 stamps, you got a free wash. I'm sure each of you experienced that a number of times. Now, another set of customers, same car wash, got a loyalty card in which they needed to collect 10 stamps rather than 8 to get a free car wash. But when they were given their card, they were given a head start with 2 stamps already added. Now, the goal was exactly the same for both sets of customers, requiring 8 car wash purchases to get a reward. But the psychology, and therefore the motivation and the outcome, was hugely different. For those who had a head start with the 2 stamps, they were already, in the framework that they saw it, 20% of the way toward a goal rather than starting from scratch. So several months later, several repetitions later, the results were in. 19% of the 8 stamp customers earned a free car wash. 34% of the Head Start group earned a free car wash. And this group cycled twice as fast on average, meaning they were ready to start over and spend more money sooner. So there was almost a 4-fold difference just in the way that it was structured. People are motivated to be partly finished with a longer task or journey than to be just beginning on an even shorter one. So to motivate action will be to frame the task to help people see where they are in the process. Now, this is something that I do routinely in working with clients, and I would offer it as a possibility. Whenever someone is in a situation, they're in it. They're not seeing the big picture. They're not looking at things in the way that we can step back and look together with them in mentor coaching. So when somebody is feeling stuck, or just from time to time, I think it's really beneficial to prompt both of us stepping back and looking at where the client's been, where they are now, and where they're going, or even just to reflect back the progress that someone's making and to look at where they are now in terms of where they were, or to see a larger process of what they're doing, for example, in a relationship, and look at the work they had already done prior to beginning with you, and how with you, you've synthesized and integrated a lot of previous work and added to that process so that they are making substantial inroads, and that acknowledges and affirms not only the process, but the success that someone's had, enhancing their wanting to seize that opportunity to further write new script for themselves and to try out new things that they may not have tried out before. Now, a framework. Let me focus on that for just a minute. How you frame something can change the meaning, and the meaning can change your mind can change your brain. So, meaning derives from the frame we place around an event or situation. So, each meaning is ours to construct. It's not there until we create it. Here's an original experiment that was done many years ago that really began the field of behavioral economics, done by Daniel Kahneman, who's written a book I highly recommend. He's a Nobel Prize laureate at Princeton, called Thinking Fast and Slow, about the two brain systems, basically. I had subjects spin a wheel that supposedly would stop at a random number between 1 and 100. And then they were asked, what percent of African countries belong to the United Nations? Now, for one group of subjects, the wheel was preset to stop on 10. For the second group, it was preset to stop on 65. The first group guessed 25% nations belong to the UN. The second group guessed 45%. Now, and the subjects insisted that the number on the wheel had no relation to the correct answer to the question or their answer. But yet, the number on the wheel the number of the wheels stopped, had profound influences on their responses. So even irrelevant information can influence judgments, which then influences decisions. And this is referred to, among other things, as priming. To, you know, think about what a different response you have when you see a silk blouse that was originally for sale at $249. It's gone through two markdowns, and you can now have it for $37. The prime is what it originally was, so that you're thinking, man, this is 10% of you. You know, instead of what is the absolute value, can you afford it, do you really want it or need it, but the focus is on that gap. So that frame makes a difference. Here's an example of how you frame a question that can make a big deal of difference. When companies automatically enroll their employees in a retirement savings plan, the employee has to make a decision to opt out, to not participate, to actually make a choice that says, I will not save for my future. So when it's automatic, it's 100% by definition, then it levels out to 86 to 94% when it's framed in this way. Now, at companies where it isn't automatic and someone has to actively decide to choose to opt in, 20% end up participating, a fourfold difference. Now, another really simple example real quick. One group of countries in Europe has an option that people can donate their organs unless they check a box that says they don't want to. In other words, they have to opt out. The rate of organ donation, 95%. Another group of countries, about half, have a form where if someone donates their organ, they have to choose to opt in. They have to initiate opting in. Rate of donation, 18%, over a fourfold difference. So to discern meaning, you need a context to surround it. The frame can even determine your state of mind. So we help clients reframe. Someone has a setback, a disappointment, or crisis, we may look at what's the opportunity here, problem to possibility. Or if someone completes a list of options or runs out of possibilities, we nudge, what else? We percolate a closed system, and the closed system has to do with staying in the comfort zone. Now, one more revisit, and I want to stop for discussion, is about focus. Remember that we get what we focus on, not what we want. So engaging in a negative or fear-based belief in order to counter it, we'll be focusing on the negative and will create what you're most trying to avoid. The more you keep running away from something, the more you engage it. So every day, several times a day, we say yes or no to many things. We say yes or no to what we focus on and what we don't, and how we focus, whether that's in a negative or positive way. And without even being consciously aware, you can focus on something you don't want and bring it about. If a belief is certain relationships can be painful, and you have to watch out for certain people and avoid them, then you focus your mind on precisely that, dead relationships and people who can hurt you. The focus draws precisely about you what you don't want and attracts it to you. When those people appear in your life, you're unconsciously drawn to them, though consciously may feel repelled by them. This ultimate paradox is why people keep having the same relationship with different people. So this emphasizes how our minds and brains are an energy field that respond to focus. Whether the focus is negative or positive, the response is to the focus. So our minds precisely and effectively create what we focus on. So we have a little bit of time for thoughts, questions, and things that about this and about the kind of the summary of a number of things we've talked about. Does this make sense? And what kind of thoughts and questions do you have?
Dave, I had a question as you were talking about thought loops. Is it fair? Would you agree that the case study I presented was about creating a new thought loop, or getting the old story was really a thought loop in my head, since it was not anything anybody had ever said to me?
I didn't hear that repetitive rumination. I heard that certain situations, especially trying something new and different, would boot up a state of mind, and the content was about feeling like a fraud or feeling exposed or being afraid that there would be something that would be there that would be revealed. And the default mode, for example, that your identity was the company that employed you, and to go out on your own would be to mean that you stand alone. And an example there about how I hear that is when you would introduce yourself in a way not as I'm part of this company and that's the identity that I have, that means you were standing alone. So at that moment, there was a bit of anxiety. Mm-hmm. About standing alone, about the separation anxiety from the whole past and from the identity, and without having solidly established a new identity, then that anxiety, even the signal of that anxiety, without it even being conscious, instantly booted up an old state of mind. And then once you're in that state of mind, it can be emotion, it can be cognitive, it can be left or right brain. So you may be in a thought loop with that until you do something to exit that.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. That helps.
More
with...
yes than I thought it was going to be when I started looking at it.
Okay. Well, what I was trying to do is differentiate, but understand, you know, what some of these thought loops could look like and how they could present themselves. But certainly, as you were describing it, that's how it felt. There probably was more rumination on my part than maybe what I also let on in the story. So,
yeah. And the
especially
key,
now.
For us or for clients, the key is not to get lost in the content. The content is not going to provide any answer. It's to be aware of the process, and especially the process of that instantaneous state change with a signal of an uncomfortable feeling.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I was, and it can present in kind of subtle patterns. I was working with someone at the end of last week, and I noticed that when there would be certain explanations, that it seemed like for both of us, there wasn't much of an energy charge about that, and she was just kind of routinely and rotely going through the situations and kind of getting lost in the detail, and I was having a little bit of struggle following the detail and seeing the relevance. And then I asked her if I could share a hunch with her. And my hunch was that whenever there was something that she was feeling uncomfortable about, that it booted up a state of mind that she would get lost in detail and talk about, and this was her, the equivalent of a negative thought loop, that she would go into exquisite detail that would be tangential. And she said, that is absolutely right. And she was aware of the specific thing that she had mentioned when she lost herself into the abstraction and the detail and the moving away from her immediate experience, because it did feel detached. And that was my signal that some process had gone on, that she had detached, and that in that moment the choice architecture was to move away from something that she was feeling without even being consciously aware of it. So we both together could reconstruct that process and look at how she could stay with her experience longer and stronger and come to know what it was, and how that could be a cue or a trigger then that she could be consciously aware of and aware of this behavior and move that into her neuroconditioning chart to look at even sooner then as this signal of all the content that she couldn't figure out was a state that she needed just to get present and move into ideal behavior, because all the detail was of no help to her whatsoever, because it was all the content of a state. And figuring out and understanding all the detail of a state is not going to be that helpful. Does that make sense as a as another parallel illustration of that?
It does. It does, and it actually triggers a little bit of my, you know, these are my responses, my typical responses when triggered. So it helps me take even my case study a little bit further.
Okay. Well, super. Super. Well, thank you all very much, and I look forward to Grace's presentation next time. I hope you have a terrific week, and I'll look forward to picking up right here next time. Bye now.
Thanks, Dave. Have a great week.
Bye-bye.